does give me great pleasure to introduce Lindsay Clark tonight. He is works some of the week with University in Cardiff, is a writer based out of Frome in Somerset, and a long way from his original roots, because the one thing I did learn from reading the backs of one of these books tonight is, and in talking to him, and you will hear, he's a Yorkshireman from Halifax. Lindsay.
Being a writer, I really don't know what I'm trying to say until I've written it down. And so I've written this down and I shall read it to you. I will try to look up with you a real there in our process video being read to you, but it will at least have the bonus of keeping me coherent. Okay? On the face of things, it seems improbable that the late 20th century should have seen a revival of serious and surprisingly widespread interest in the ancient art of alchemy. After all, even in the work of Isaac Newton and Robert Boyle, two of its most celebrated investigators, we can already see the tide of energy shifting away from the study of matter in the sacred tradition of the medieval worldview towards the new skeptical chemistry and the development of the scientific method of replicable experiment. The later evolution of Enlightenment thinking, which still largely dominates the intellectual mainstream, was entirely opposed in spirit to the heretic nature of alchemical assumptions, vocabulary, and imagery. And so successful has the scientific method been in advancing knowledge of the power of technology, that it's not surprising if today's skeptical chemists, physicists, and biologists throw up their hands in dismay at what they see as a regression to a primitive mode of thought. Even Jung himself, who did more than anyone else to restore the dignity of alchemical inquiry, came away from his first encounter with the weird cavalcade of green lions, hermaphrodites, and self-consuming serpents depicted in alchemical texts with the opinion that they were something off the beaten track and rather silly. Only later, motivated by a powerful dream, did you return to them in a more committed spirit and begin to realize that the serious alchemists were not only his precursors in the evolution of psychology as a science of the soul, but were also engaged in an imaginative enterprise towards the re-sacralization of what the Orthodox Christianity of their time regarded as the fallen state of the material world. In any case, as the images of alchemy insist, the face of things is rarely where their deep truth lies. And here we are, against the odds, in the lecture theatre of a respected university, gathered together over a period of weeks to puzzle over what the ancient science of the soul may still hold of value for us in our time. It seems to me that only a significant confluence of a slowly turning tide of cultural transition, with sometimes urgent individual experience, could lie behind the serious appeal of such an event. Certainly, I know such was the case with the growth of my own interest in alchemy, and it seems to me that big things such as this can drift off into the intellectual stratosphere if they are not kept in close touch with lived experience. So I hope you will come to understand my reasons if I begin by speaking to my theme in personal terms, before attempting a more generalized consideration of what its implications may be for the wider evolution of consciousness in our time. Around 20 years ago, my first novel was accepted for publication. Telling the story of a white man's ordeal of initiation through an encounter with a witch in Africa, it had originally been a dense text, more than 500 pages long, entitled Nigredo, after that arduous transitional phase of the alchemical opus in which darkness prevails and everything threatens to go wrong. But earlier disappointing responses from publishers had persuaded me to strip the novel down to half its length and change the title to something like that. In that form, it proved acceptable to the editors at Jonathan Capers. But the book still had the look about it of the only egg that this chicken might lay. So, before the contract was signed, I was asked whether I had anything else in progress. And it happened. I did have a couple of drafts of stories which had both got stuck at a relatively early stage. Conceived under the heavy influence of John Towers' powerful novel, The Makers, one of them told of an initiatory encounter between a young poet and an old poet, and was a loose reworking of the medieval story of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. The other idea I had begun to sketch out is a novella based on the true story of the 19th century alchemist Thomas South, who had insisted that his daughter, Mary Ann, burn all copies of her own remarkable book, A Suggestive Enquiry into the Hermetic Mystery, because according to him, her text had revealed far too much of the alchemical secret. I was puzzling over which of these two still undeveloped ideas to submit, when it occurred to me that the film of John Fowles' novel, The French Tennisman, had done an interesting job of combining one story set in the 19th century with another set in the 20th. Could I do something similar? So I rewrote the opening slightly, sandwiched the start of the 19th century tale between the two opening chapters of the 20th, made up a list of chapter headings as though I knew exactly where this interwoven narrative device was taking me, and submitted it to Cape. It excited them far more than the first novel had done, and so I was committed to spending the next 3 years inside the hermetic labyrinth of bewilderment, trying to work out what it was all about. The book eventually became The Chemical Wedding, which went on to win the Whitbread Prize, and is the reason why I was invited here today. Now, I have three reasons for sharing this confessional anecdote with you. Firstly, and I shall have more to say about this later, because the initially arbitrary conjunction of two apparently unrelated stories illustrates the principal theme of this talk, that something new can get made for life through the difficult process of the mysterium conjunctionis, the reconciliation of opposing forces. Secondly, because it gives some sort of hint that one cannot begin to write imaginatively about alchemy without the writing itself becoming a work of alchemy. And even though I'm a novelist, not a practicing alchemist, the alchemical theme on which I have chosen to write put me through a sometimes grueling process of personal transformation before the work itself could be achieved. Though not everyone would agree that the end result was pure gold, the struggle did give me some experience of what I'm talking about. I should like to add, as a footnote, and as a caveat, that a talk about alchemy, if it is to be true to its theme, ought to have something of the character of an alchemical treatise about it too, proceeding not by the usual means of conceptual logic, but through a sequence of images designed to elicit responses at levels deeper than that of the managerial intellect. Lastly, I share this anecdote with you because it may give you an indication of the degree to which alchemy had begun to play an active part in the evolution of my personal consciousness long before I came to write the novel. But to say more about that, I will have to speak more personally still. As you just heard, I grew up in the industrial north of England and already knew by the age of 6 that I wanted to be a writer. The inspiration came when I began to read for myself the stories in the copies of Grimm's fairy tales that my mother had bought for me from Woolworths. I had been excited by the way that the book opened like a magic door onto a landscape utterly different from that of the smoky world around me, a landscape that was at once alien and strangely familiar, as though it mirrored back to me the hitherto unfocused aspects of my own inward world. That's one of the most important things that a book can do for us, and it left me wanting to tell stories as well as to read them. So I wrote pages and pages of what I am now sure was quite dreadful stuff throughout my teens, and in my innocence I went up to Cambridge to read English, imagining that such a course of study would provide a kind of apprenticeship that would help me to become a writer. What I didn't know was that the English faculty wasn't turning out writers, it was turning out critics. And critics are such ferocious intellectuality that it quickly robbed me of any conviction that I could ever be a writer myself. It took me the best part of 20 years to recover the confidence to try to write seriously again. Meanwhile, I did what many other failed would-be writers had done before me. In my days as a student, I have come alive to the terrible injustices that prevailed across the planet and believed that education was a means of beginning to right them. Employing the heavily rational, humanist, and entirely secular system of values I had acquired at Cambridge, I became a member of the unofficial lay clerisy that the universities were turning out, the gallant band of liberal-minded intellectuals who believed they were transforming society by working within the state education system and spreading the word of reason across the land. You probably met the kind of young man I was then. I still run into him every now and then, and he usually gives me a healthy hard time. In my day, I was pretty good at convincing both myself and others that there was no meaning to life other than that imposed on it by the sceptical, largely masculine exercise of human reason. And for a time, I thought it was working. Suffice it to say that under a growing awareness of the contradictions in my work, the pressures of early marriage and fatherhood, and an abiding sense of personal failure, I was retreating into an ever falser, more withdrawn condition when, aged 30, in 1970, my embattled ego suffered a massive insult of discovery that my then wife was in love with a friend and my marriage was over. As my brittle world collapsed, I too went through a brief but intense episode of breakdown. It lasted for 2 days and 3 sleepless nights, during which time I was possessed by a frenzy of violent emotions such as no reasonable man likes to own as his. Long exiled feelings flooded back with a vengeance, and beyond whatever words were spoken, I felt to be up against a cold, lunar principle, impervious to all but its own laws, against which my proprietorial ego raged in vain. At that point, as Joseph Campbell would say, I dropped into the unconscious. Or to use the kind of metaphor with which the medieval writers I had studied at Cambridge would have been comfortable, I made a journey into the other world. For the mythical fact is that while still dimly aware of my external circumstances, I was elsewhere, in the interior, traversing an arduous terrain and encountering some fearsome figures on the way. There are passages in my novels where I try to dramatize through fictional events something of the quality of that journey. But some truths are less credible than fiction and are largely unpublishable. Let me just say that in exhaustive acceptance of a kind of defeat, I eventually fell asleep. And when I woke up, I found that the world had changed. It was as if frequencies of information I had jammed for years were beaming freely around me. I woke to the exhilarating sense that the unfolding flow of life was not only larger, but richer in meaning and interest than my tightly managed model of it had been. And I felt an almost virgin taste for it. But the change was in me, and it turned out that the alteration was both radical and lasting. Something had died, and when my head locked off, I was learning to think with the heart. My collapsed ego would build that quickly enough ago, of course, but the terms on which I lived my life were irrevocably altered. After the need to recognize more of the nature of that transforming journey for myself, and in the hope that it might help others to similar recognitions of their own, I thought I had to find both a context for it and a language. And that search began as a quest for meaningful images. The first that came was the image of the Tower of Fool, with its reminder of what an untutored fool I'd been, and its promise of a wiser fool figure in the offing. And it's from my study of the tarot that I first found my way into the rich store of emblems through which alchemy speaks of transformation. For guidance there, I turned principally to Jung. Not in therapy or analysis, just through a process of free-ranging reading following my nose. And of course, like all who try to approach alchemical material through the analytic intellect, I quickly found myself confused by the twists and turns of that slippery fellow, Mercurius Duplex, who dissolves into thin air just at the moment when you think you're about to pin him down. But what gradually emerged into focus for me was an enlarging sense of the beauty and subtlety of the alchemical vision, and the degree to which it offered a vocabulary of images that confirmed the value of the more fugitive and elusive aspects of my recent experience, and enabled me to relate to it in fuller recognition and with greater imaginative energy. Much later, I tried to convey something of the urgent excitement of that discovery in a longish speech I gave to the old poet Edwin Nesbitt in my novel The Chemical Wedding. Trying to persuade his sceptical young friend Alex Barkin of the contemporary relevance of alchemy, Edward says, "Materialism leaves us trapped in a world that won't hold together. It's centrifugal. It splits at every turn into the 10,000 things, each neatly labelled with a PhD thesis. In the meantime, we become more and more obsessed with what we mistake for our real needs, hopes, fears, and more estranged from our birthright membership of a coherent universe. We can't live that way, not for much longer. And the world can't live with us, not like this. We have to change. We have to find a vision that will help us to change, that will restore dignity and meaning by altering our relationship to the delicate web that supports our life. Everyone knows it deep down, but we're lost, confused, complicit in our own bad dreams. So how to realize the whole vision of life? Not some self-sealing intellectual construct, no shabby patchwork compromise, but a regenerative, transcendent change. One that reconciles matter with spirit, heart with mind, the female in us and the male, the darkness and the light. That was the problem which I gave the spiritual insight for the true alchemist. That was the elixir, the stone, the gold. They are all symbols for what cannot be said, only experienced. The alchemists, he declares, were part of a tradition that has always tried to seal like coal, however painful the process of holding its contradictions together. They knew that matter and spirit are indivisible, that everything is translucent, permeable, infinite, in its marvellous covenant of meaning. And he ends with the declaration that the Hermetic tradition has always offered a vision whereby men and women might recover their experience in its wholeness. It offers a technique for achieving that vision, and we need to know how to know it now, for that is how things deeply are, and not only human life depends on it. Now, the language in which the old poet expresses himself may be a touch hectoring and overdramatic, but I believe that his heart is in the right place. And there's a good deal of truth in what he has to say. So what were the main themes that emerged from my own investigations into alchemy at that time? Firstly, what I drew from them was a vigorous confirmation of the visionary insight that had been borne in upon me immediately after my breakdown, when I walked out into the quiet water meadows of a sunlit northern morning to be met by a profound sense of the unitary nature of being. The world felt one, singular, and whole, and I was no longer apart from it, but a part of it, my own soul resonating as it had not done since I was a child, in answer to the living soul of the world around me. Everything else would follow from that experience, and perhaps nowhere outside the lines of the most sublime poetry was its unitary nature expressed more clearly than in the magisterial declarations of that seminal alchemical text, the emerald tablets of Hermes Trismegistus. What is below is like what is above, and what is above is like what is below, for the performing of the marvels of the one thing. I should add that this happened to me back in 1970, when there was no widespread understanding of, and very little interest in, those ecological insights which the accelerating threat of planetary disaster have made commonplace today. And I myself have been educated in the scientific tradition of thought, so the impact of this captivating experience on me is all the more powerful. Now, as I've already suggested, Mercurius Duplex is the presiding spirit of the alchemical vision, an elusive figure embodying a complex of opposites, forever unchanging, yet never quite the same, as unstable as quicksilver and impossible to pin down. So there would be nothing fixed and permanent about that insight into the unitary nature of being, except the degree to which it has altered forever my way of perceiving things. Otherwise it kept, and still keeps, slipping back and forth across the boundary between consciousness and unconsciousness. And with this came the understanding that though all things are interrelated through the great chain of being, the delicate web that supports our life, various phenomena are in quite different states of evolution towards consciousness. Furthermore, the insights of the alchemists suggested that all things are an interfusion of matter and spirit, each seeking to realize and celebrate its part in the union with the whole. And because we too are an integral part of that seamless process, we do to ourselves what we do to the world that appears to be outside it. And what we do to the world, we are also doing to ourselves. Thus our inward condition will inescapably project itself onto our work with the world. And if there's an unholy mess out there, it mirrors the state of confusion inside us. Yet the aspirations of the alchemists also seem to demonstrate that by a proper use of the creative imagination, we can raise the value of both inward and outward experience through a disciplined process of necessary change. But such work could only be done successfully, they insisted, by entering into right relations with the right material at the right time. The various alchemical texts all agree that the one thing required to begin the work is the prima materia. They are, however, confusingly diverse in their assertions about just what that mysterious first matter is, even though some of them, like the Gloria Mundi of 1526, confidently assert that it is to be found everywhere and is therefore despised by all, though next to the human soul, it is the most precious thing on earth. And the material was given so many disparate names: mercury, sulphur, salt, lead, earth, water, fire, dew, virgin, dragon, etc., that the alchemists were clearly speaking in symbolic terms rather than as some literal substance. By the same token, the secret fire that was needed for performing the alchemical processes, a fire that does not burn, and which had to be extracted from the first matter, and yet was also, and at the same time, the means of its extraction, was clearly not what we usually understand by the term fire. Now, I confess to having found the enigmatic and paradoxical nature of the alchemical texts as perplexing as the next man. And yet their language and emblems worked, and still work, a curiously exciting enchantment over my imagination, as though, like the often elusive images of dreams, they speak to something inside me deeper than the reach of the analytic intellect. When I think about them now, I'm reminded of how the great American poet Wallace Stevens wrote of poetry as a language which speaks to the soul by almost voluptuously resisting the intellect. and of how Anne Baring and Jules Cashford in their fine book The Myth of the Goddess write of the current need for a new poetic language that would allow back into consciousness a sensibility that is holistic, animistic and lunar in origin, one that explores flux, continuity and phases of alternation, offering an image not of exclusive realities nor of final beginnings and endings, but of infinite cycles of transformation. Such a language of the poetic imagination must be, of its very nature, paradoxical, because it strives to hold together apparently contrary forces. And that creative tension, it seems to me, goes to the very heart of the alchemical enterprise. When it comes to describing the method of alchemical procedures, one formula tends to recur throughout the texts, solve et coagula, which, in synoptic form, instructs the would-be adept that the prima materia must first be dissolved into its constituent elements before it can be brought together again into a newly unified whole. Another version of this formula tells the alchemist to make the fixed volatile and the volatile fixed. In technical terms, this apparently refers to the process of reflux distillation by which liquid is heated until it evaporates into a gas which rises, cools and condenses into a liquid which is then fed back through the retort into the original liquid with transforming effect. If we translate this into psychological terms, it refers to the process by which consciousness arises out of the darkness of the unconscious, illuminating the conscious ego with insights that subsequently allow for a more complete discrimination of unconscious contents into still larger consciousness. For the alchemists, the two processes, one external and material, the other internal and spiritual, were identical. For the outer transformation could not happen without the same process working inwardly, thus affirming the essential unity of matter and spirit. But as anyone who has seriously engaged with these processes will confirm, the effort required is long, arduous, and at times extremely painful. For when one begins to dissolve a complex situation into its constituent parts by bringing them into the light of consciousness, one soon discovers that some of those elements are in a state of profound, contradictory tension with one another, and to such a volatile degree that they continuously threaten to tear apart, or in alchemical terms, to burst the crucible in which those tensions are held together. A simple analogy might make the process clearer. A man and a woman fall hopelessly in love in what they take for a blissful stage of union which leads them into marriage. After a time, uncomfortable aspects of their relationship of which they have previously been unaware begin to oppress them. Conflicts emerge and develop. Efforts to resolve those conflicts prove ever more difficult, and the situation deteriorates until divorce begins to seem a desirable option. Only if a massive effort of honest self-disclosure, along with mutual recognition and acceptance, is undertaken and sustained, can true reconciliation and a new, more conscious union be achieved. It also requires a withdrawal of projections and a measure of self-sacrifice, amounting at times to a kind of ego death on both sides. And the difficulty of that process is evidenced by the divorce statistics of a culture that remains largely uneducated in such transformational dynamics. When the alchemists sought to speak of such matters as they saw them at work both in their alembics and in their own souls, they did so in archetypal terms, illustrating their procedures through the changing nature of the relationship between the king and the queen, for example, or of sol and luna, sun and moon, which represent the often competitive relationship between the masculine and feminine principles, both inwardly and outwardly. There's a marvellous illustration to the 16th century text called Aurora Concernens, depicts figures of the sun and moon jousting with one another. He is armoured and riding on a lion, she is naked on a griffin's back. Each seeks to unseat the other with a lance, yet both are protected by shields. And the subtlety of the illustration consists of the fact that the sun carries the emblem of the moon on his shield, while the moon is protected by the emblem of the sun on hers. The picture illustrates the first stage of the alchemical work in which the king and queen, Sol and Luna, are in a volatile state of opposition with one another, a conflict which leads through the course of many distillatory circulations to a state of death and putrefaction, a black, blacker than black, known as the Negredo, in which the opposed forces are dissolved so that each loses their separate identity. Out of that blackness, a scintilla of white light eventually appears, heralding the cleansing stage known as the Albedo, through which, if the tension of contrary forces has been properly sustained, is eventually achieved, the royal marriage of the Rubedo, the Mysterium Conjunctionis, in which all the contraries are reconciled, and an enlarged sense of life, a newly unified state of consciousness, the gold, the elixir, the philosopher's stone itself, mysteriously arises. These are the themes and processes I try to explore in my novel, The Chemical Wedding, which is, I suppose, a kind of alchemical text for our time, presented as fiction. Its title, borrowed from a celebrated 17th century text, is itself another emblem for the reconciliation of the opposites. And by structuring the book around two initially disparate stories set in different time frames, was on the commission course, I sought to dramatise the process within the dual form of the narrative itself, looking for a way to bring the whole thing through to a sense of imaginative unity. The plain fact that I was largely unconscious of this aim when I first conceived the idea of the novel is an indication of the degree to which the 3 years of often bewildering work on the project mirrored my own struggle through into a larger degree of consciousness. Now, it's all very well for me to speak of the self-imposed tribulations of a novelist in this regard, but I'm sure that among many of you, the question will already have arisen as to whether the true alchemists were speaking in symbolic terms of mystical techniques for the raising of consciousness when they wrote of these things, or whether they were, in fact, offering a coded account of procedures by which base metal could indeed be transmuted into gold. As I said earlier, I'm not a practicing alchemist, so I'm not really qualified to answer the question with any authority, but I would suggest that the divisive either-or terms in which it is posed may be missing the point, for it's quite possible that they were in fact doing both. As a pioneer of depth psychology, looking for evidence to support his theory of the collective unconscious, Jung tended to view the Hermetic texts in psychological terms, interpreting the events that the alchemists observed in their alembics as projections of the unconscious contents of their minds. But in paragraph 394 of his great work, Psychology and Alchemy, he records how Martin Buber's astounding definition of the imagination as the starry man, the celestial or super-celestial body, suggested other possibilities. Imagination, Jung declared, is perhaps the most important key to the understanding of the opus, for it is a physical activity, the most important key, physical activity that can be fitted into the cycle of material changes that brought these about and is brought about by them in its turn. In this way, the alchemist related himself not only to the unconscious, but directly to the very substance which he hoped to transform through the power of the imagination. Thus the alchemist is operating simultaneously in the psychic and the physical realms, and changes are being brought about in both. An interaction of the observer and the observed, which seems to prefigure in intriguing ways the relatively recent discovery of quantum physics, that the behaviour of matter at molecular levels is conditioned by the approach of the scientist observing it. What Jung was attempting to articulate here may not be easy to grasp, but it lies, I would suggest, at the heart, not just of alchemy, but of all genuinely creative, imaginative activity. And part of the difficulty we have in grasping it arises from the fact that our culture tends to reinforce only a limited understanding of the nature of the imagination. Thus there is a tendency when we try to grasp the imagination simply by thinking about it conceptually, to reduce it to a description of its various functions. It gets defined, for example, as the capacity to visualize things which are not actually present to our outward senses. So that I have only to say the word elephant, and suddenly a large animal is present to your inner eye which was not there a moment before. Or we can consider the way the imagination is able to transfigure things into forms other than those by which they usually present themselves to the senses. Magritte's painting of a pipe, which insists that it is not a pipe, makes us startlingly aware of this function. Or we might consider the metaphorical way in which the poetic imagination uses images drawn from one set of things to make statements about another, or to present them in an illuminating new perspective. Thus an ordinary pair of boots or a stick-back chair remain just that until Van Gogh comes along with his oil paints and imagination and transforms those everyday objects into something visionary. We might go further than this by considering the relationship of imagination to time. Doesn't imagination play such a large part in helping us to remember what has happened in the past, for example, that one might wonder whether memory itself is an act of imagination? Certainly it is through the imagination that we try to envisage what will happen in the future, and in that respect there are times when it seems to turn its power against us by conceiving of fearsome things which might conceivably happen but probably won't, and of things which don't exist at all. It was probably for this reason that Francis Bacon once suggested that the imagination should be tied down with weights, not given wings. Such a pragmatic view of the imagination seems to prevail in the general assumptions of a system of education where the imagination is seen as a more or less useful adjunct to other more reliable and rationally accountable methods of intellectual procedure. But there is another larger way of thinking about the imagination, which certainly prevailed among the alchemists and has always been alive and vital among the poets. For them, reality was not something fixed and impermeable, simply there, but a product of our vision, and therefore always porous to the transforming power of the imagination. Wasn't it something along these lines that Coleridge was thinking and feeling when he wrote in his biography of Literaria that the imagination is the prime agent of human perception? Wasn't William Blake rejoicing in this life-creating, world-endowing aspect of the imagination when he declared that to me this whole world is one continuous vision of fancy and imagination? But this view of the imagination is much older than the Romantic poets and philosophers, and when Newland, the lexicographer, defined imagination as the star in man, he was affirming a creative link between human nature and the nature of the cosmos that goes back to the Gnostics, to the mythopoeic imagination of the ancient world, and perhaps further still to the primordial animistic vision of our inalienable involvement in the living intelligence of the universe we inhabit. It will already be clear that my own view of the imagination is close to this ancient tradition. I regard the imagination as the means by which, with more or less psychic energy, we shape our vision of the world and our place within it, and also as the primary means by which we can transform it. But what matters, of course, is the degree to which we are conscious of what we are doing. When I work with my students in my writing classes, I encourage them not only to think of the imagination this way, but to try, through a kind of thought experiment, actually to imagine the imagination. The image I ask them to visualize is that of two overlapping circles, one of which represents the outer world, everything outside themselves which is not them, and the other representing their inner world, everything which is only them, their thoughts, feelings, hopes, fears, intuitions, dreams, the entire realm of their private experience. What they end up with at the end of the experiment looks like that alone, rather than in other good version of this. Any mathematicians among you might recognize this as a Venn diagram, but it is a very ancient symbol indeed, originally illustrating the meeting of heaven and earth through which life gets made. For this reason, it forms the ground plan of many sacred sites and was co-opted by Christianity as the Vaticapiscus, the Fisher's Valley, an emblem of Christ as the intersection of heaven and earth, eternity and time. But what I ask my students to concentrate on is the almond-shaped area of overlap between the two circles as the place where they actually live. That region where their inner world is in a permanent state of negotiation with all the intelligence that is reaching them from the outside world about what is real and true. I think of that area of overlap, it's known as the mandorla from the Italian word for almond, as the house of the imagination. It's an image of the place where all the time our inner world merges with the outer world to shape the experience from which each of us builds our personal myth. We don't just live in the public world around us, nor only in the private world within. We live in the mandorla, where those two worlds meet and negotiate about reality with one another as a more or less vigorous exercise of the imagination. It's our gateway to meaning, and the problem is to keep it open so that the claims of both outer and inner world are honored. We all know people who live in narrow mandoras by, for example, overrating external quantifiable facts at the expense of inner values, such as the feeling dimension of any given situation. Or conversely, people who are so lost inside private myths that they ignore all evidence, trying to reach them from the outside that might call their myth into question. Nor are these things constant, for the scope of our mandorla fluctuates all the time. But the greater the area of overlap, then the larger and more inclusive the embrace of our imaginative vision. If the two circles were to overlap completely, then I imagine one would have a sphere representing total knowledge, reminiscent of the medieval image of God as a circle whose center is everywhere and circumference nowhere. But we are only human, betwixt and between creatures, caught up in contradictions, and the challenge is to keep the mandorla as open as possible. The nature of the conflict and the challenge it presents was brilliantly defined by the late poet laureate Ted Hughes in an essay on myth and education. The real problem, he says there, comes from the fact that outer world and inner world are interdependent at every moment. We are simply the locus of their collision. And whether we like it or not, our life is what we are able to make of that collision and struggle. So what we need is a faculty that embraces both worlds simultaneously. A large, flexible grasp, an inner vision which holds wide open, like a great theatre, the arena of contention, and which pays equal respect to both sides. This really is imagination. This is the faculty we mean when we talk about the imagination of great artists. The character of great works is exactly this, that in them, the full presence of the inner world combines with and is reconciled to the full presence of the outer world. And in them we see that the laws of these two worlds are not contradictory at all. They are all one inclusive system. So the proper exercise of the imagination is an energetic process of negotiation between the outer world and the inner world, through which we strive to hold together their often contradictory poles. By engaging in that process, we can begin to work extraordinary changes. For it is through the meeting and reconciliation of opposites that something new gets made for life. In that respect, the imagination is related to a word which comes from the same root, magic. The power to bring about those changes in the world which seem to defy the normal laws of causality. I would even go so far as to suggest that in its conjuring and transformative power, magic is the active principle of the imagination. Before you start imagining me as a member of some occult coven, however, let me add to what has already been said the importance of recognizing two different aspects of the imagination. Firstly, its inventive aspect, by which we are free to make up the story of our life and world. And secondly, its sympathetic aspect, by which it acknowledges the right of others to do the same. For it is through the sympathetic aspect of the imagination that we perceive the world as others experience it, that we feel how things are for them in the world that they inhabit, and begin to relate to their sense of reality in the spirit of compassionate understanding. It seems to me absolutely vital that in all aspects of our creativity, we strive to hold these two aspects of the imagination together. For when the inventive aspect loses touch with the ethical or sympathetic aspect, the results can be calamitous. And when the ethical aspect loses touch with the poetic, then the work soon becomes dry, abstract, theoretical, and dogmatic. Imagined in this way, as the conjunction linking all our lives, the imagination becomes an instrument of liberation, one to which we all have equal access, and which, by its own intrinsic standards, serves not only to celebrate and enlarge our common humanity, but also to invest with a newly heightened sensitivity, our relationship to the living world around us. It's in this way, as a continuous attempt to reconcile the contrary elements of our lives, inner and outer, spirit and matter, ego and soul, the masculine principle and the feminine, the conscious and unconscious elements of our being, that the alchemists understood the imagination as the truly creative principle of our lives and the secret fire that lay behind their work. In this respect, I believe they still have a great deal to teach us, and not least in the example that their frequent failures give us of just how difficult the process of transformation is. For as I tried to indicate earlier with the analogy of a married couple drifting towards divorce, our chemical procedures can offer us instructive metaphors for the process of individuation and for the creative conduct of our personal emotional lives. By the same token, they can illuminate the kind of imaginative energy required for the resolution of apparently intractable conflicts in the political domain. The kind of effort that was made, for example, in South Africa through the Truth and Justice Commission to achieve the transition from a society divided by apartheid to a nation living in the greater degree of harmony than many would have believed possible. And it's hard to see how the Israelis and the Palestinians will ever achieve peaceful coexistence without a truly committed effort to engage in the same arduous processes. But the contemporary relevance of our chemical imagery goes deeper than the attempt to find solutions for local conflicts. With their sensitive responsiveness to the soul of the world, the anima mundi, as a living and evolving intelligence, the alchemists prefigure the emergence of deep ecological thought in our own time. The kind that recognizes that short-term environmental fixes will not be enough, and that what is required for the decent survival of our own and other species is a profound transformation of our relationship to the planet that sustains our life. And such a transformation will not come about without a change in the way we envision the natural world and our place inside it. Against the onslaught of bad news that leaves us wondering whether it may already be too late, there are two precarious signs of hope. An unprecedented number of people worldwide are now engaged in the often painful search for greater self-knowledge. And along with that, we have seen a rapid increase in the understanding of and concern for ecological issues. But the affairs of the world are still governed by an outworn patriarchal tradition of thought, infatuated by its own technological power, and enthralled to a dim materialism on the one hand, and a literal-minded fundamentalism on the other. There appears, nevertheless, to be a necessary evolution of consciousness trying to happen in our time, and such events as this series of talks seem to be a part of it. It may often falter in its attempts to find a language adequate to the demands of its own often confusing processes, but at its best it represents, I think, not a regression into irrationality, such as the skeptic's fear, but a movement through into trans-rationality, a new conjunction of solar and lunar modes of apprehending the world, which values all the gains for consciousness that have been made by the discriminating methods of rational inquiry, yet seeks to bring them into closer creative relation with those less quantifiable aspects of our experience that have been undervalued for too long. Those aspects tend to be associated with the feminine principle that has often been derided in Western culture, that seems now to be reasserting itself with renewed power and authority. I mean such aspects as feeling seen as a rational function by which we evaluate the facts of any given situation. Intuition as a reliable guide to deeper understanding, and an alert response to the wisdom of intelligence arising from the vast wellspring of what I now think of as the ecological unconscious. In particular, that furnished by dreams, of which I'll say more later if you'd like me to. The imagination, both inventive and ethical, is the function through which we have access to these aspects of our being. And all artists, sensitive to their own creative process, will tell you that it is through its efforts to reconcile the often contrary poles of the outer and inner worlds, and to allow something new to arise out of their conjunction, that new work gets made. On their own terms, the alchemists were artists of that creative order, attempting to bring about a practical conjunction of science and poetry, in a transforming vision of the world. Their images of the royal marriage of Sol and Luna and the new life transcending gender differences that arises from it were attempts to offer guidance into the mystery of the creative reconciliation of the opposites. Having found in my own quest for self-knowledge and a deeper understanding of the critical issues we all face today, that what alchemy offers us has been worth rather more to me than gold, I hope I've managed to share with you something of what I take to be its continuing importance in our own time. Thank you for listening to this.
So would anybody like to open the questions?
Lindsay, would you tell us more about dreams? I know that you said once that chemical wedding started from a dream.
It actually, the whole novel came out of a dream of the opposites. Thank you for that. In fact, the novel, which is around 500 pages long, was a desperate attempt to get into the public arena, a dream that had come to me at a particular moment in my life that I thought was sufficiently important to share with other people. It came from early in the 1980s, when some of you will remember, one of the world was in a pretty powerful state. There was a real genuine fear at that time of the possibility of nuclear warfare between the West and the Soviet Union. And the women were gathering at Queen of Commons trying to prevent the development of these things. And at that point, my stepdaughter came to me and said, how have you got the world into such a mess? What is it? What have you done? Why have you got like this? What are you going to do about it? And I did my best to answer her, which wasn't a very good answer. That is the best I could do consciously. And then I was spent that night worrying about it. And when I was asleep, this dream came to me in which a woman had an idea of how to solve the problem. And the problem was that the world leaders had to surrender the keys that would ignite the nuclear weaponry to her. Which they did, somewhat reluctantly. They were all over and rather tired men, but they passed over these keys because they didn't really know what to do with themselves to help. And she opted and said, the Pope will have these keys. And I thought, even my dream of the Pope. And the Pope looked at the key for a long time and then thought, the Quakers show the keys. The Quakers show. Now for me, that dream just represents a wonderful pattern of reconciliation of the opposites. The problem begins in the old dying patriarchal male tradition of technological power. The whole idea of nuclear weaponry is in the sense the obverse of alchemy, unlocking the secrets of matter, the energy locked inside matter for entirely destructive purposes. Very masculine things to try to do. And they have to surrender their authority from the male side and beyond the feminine side. And she, rather than arrogating this to herself, decides that the problem has to be passed from the practical material realm through to the spiritual realm, represented by the Pope. Again, going back from the male to the female principles there. And he, rather than keeping it for himself and deciding what's going to be done, passes it across to the Quakers. Now, part of the dream is what the Quakers mean there. And for me, Quakers are so called because they quake when they're called to speak. The reason why they're quaking is because there's this tension inside them that they don't actually want to get up and speak because they're embarrassed, but there's this thing going on inside them that says they absolutely have to. So their whole autonomic nervous system starts shaking. And how come these words that they hadn't really anticipated they were going to say before the meeting began? That shaking is what happens when people, someone's trying to hold the opposites together. So the keepers of the keys are those individuals among us who are doing their damnedest to hold the opposites together rather than allowing them to split apart in a fissured process which would lead to the extermination of all of us. Now that was presented to me in a dream. It's an extraordinary dream. I can't say I have that kind of dream every night. But nonetheless, it's one of the many dreams I've had. But it instructed me that there's something inside me, or something has access to the inside of me, which is wiser and deeper in its insight than my unassisted rationality or unassisted intellectuality in my mind have access to. So I profoundly trust them. For me, it's an example of the degree to which we need to open ourselves up to aspects of our experience which are profoundly valuable and yet which can get dismissed, as they have been by a certain adult writer, as a system of exclusion. you're something we just, we have dreams to get rid of the stuff that we don't need.
Mm-hmm.